to Resounds, arts and culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
A few Montana actors, such as Gary Cooper and Myrna Loy, found success during the golden age of Hollywood. For more than a century, Montana has supplied a rich variety of film and musical entertainment and personalities, from daredevils to dancers, but mostly unknown, unknown until now. Brian D'Ambrosio's new book, Montana Entertainers, Famous and Almost Forgotten, gives us a glimpse of many unsung heroes and heroines of the entertainment world. Welcome to the studio, Brian.
Thank you for having me. I know we've had a relationship for a few years now, and it's all been in the digital world. So it's nice to hop out of the virtual world and get into the real one with you. So thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming down to the studio. Certainly your book is the first that I know of any sort of anthology of Montana entertainers, actors. What brought it upon? I mean, what made you decide to do that book?
There are about three or four subjects in particular that I've always been fascinated with. And always, I mean, you know, 10, 15 years now. Taylor Gordon, who is from White Sulphur Springs and went on to become one of the premier figures in the Harlem Renaissance. Steve Reeves, who found fame and fortune mostly in Europe playing Hercules, who mm-hmm. was from Glasgow. Irene Lentz, who was a fashion designer who was so famous that she was simply known as Irene, and she was from Baker. And Julian L. Tinge, who was a one-time Butte resident, who went on to become the country's first and most famous female impersonator. So I had a couple of these names that have been spinning around and swirling around in my head for years and years, and I thought maybe, you know, I could expand on one of those and turn it into a full-fledged biography. But then I realized that the mini biography works for me well, and three out of the last four books I've worked on have been dense with smaller biographies where, you know, 500-word snippets or 800-word segments or 1,000-word entries. And for me, whether it's the shot of Montana, the movie book, or Montana and the NFL, that works better for me, mm-hmm. I think, because I have such a vast interest in so many different subjects that that I could be on a balance 70 or 80 or 90 or 100 subjects better than I can concentrate just on one. So
that's very interesting because we just had John Tolliver in the studio, and he wrote 700 pages about George Bird Grinnell, which is a fabulous book, but it takes a certain personality to want to know that much information.
Right.
And I think the formula that you're using about whether it's movies or sports figures, people can easily just pick up a book and thumb through it and find what they're interested in.
Correct. Yeah, I think that format just, you know, works perfectly. And this is supposed to be enjoyable. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be entertaining, you know, no pun intended. But, you know, what I like the most is when someone will pick it up and go through it and they'll go right to a photo and they'll say, oh, I remember when Charlie Pride was playing. I was at this bar when Charlie Pride was playing, or Charlie Pride lived on Piosta Street next door to me, or two houses down, or my daughter Sophia, her great-grandfather just showed up unannounced, as he always does, traveling around the country at 95 years old, and showed up at the front door yesterday at 95, and I handed him a book. And this morning, he was summoned through it, and he remembers the Coburn family. The Coburn family were something like royalty up in the Glasgow, Malta area, along where the High Line is. And he could remember one of the elder Coburns who wrote a lot of pulp fiction, and he heard stories about the younger Coburn, Wallace Coburn, who opened up a film studio in Zortman in 1916. And to me, I thought that was so much fun to be able to reminisce and talk about some of these great forgotten characters or families that at one time people had a connection to, and some of them, you know, they're so hard to even figure out even now. There's some of them who are just so elusive and almost complete mysteries, even to big film encyclopedias. And to me, that's so how someone could make 100 movies from, you know, in the early 1920s, but leave almost no footprint or no trace or not even a decent obituary. So,
and you have to ask yourself, how does somebody from Baker, Montana become a fashion designer anyway? I mean, what I found fascinating about a lot of these characters, particularly people from the early days, a lot of people from Butte, of course, because Butte and Helena were the where people lived.
Correct.
But a lot of small town people populate this book.
Right. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, isn't that wonderful? You know, Irene Lentz in particular, it was fun going back and piecing together some of her early days, because when you go back into many of the newspaper archives and looking for information about the Lentz family, you will see snippets that mention, you know, the dad and uncle who ran a dry goods store. But some of the announcements are really quite adorable and amusing. That young Irene had walked over, you know, was part of a choir that sang at the local nursing home. So those are the kinds of things that got into the newspapers back then. Or you'd see something that said, Irene Lentz, you know, 6, and father, age, and friend went on an automobile trip. And those are the kinds of snippets that you'd find in the newspaper. So, but for someone like Lentz who wanted to go to Hollywood, and she made it. And I think that is just so intriguing to me. And some of them took odd kind of paths. Like Thomas Wilson was a character actor who was from Helena, and he was a boxer and a sailor, and he was he's a military veteran, and somehow ended up on the vaudeville circuit and ended up in some Hal Roach comedies.
So you've organized this book chronologically based on when these people were born. And we may know some of the more famous figures, but who were the really early entertainers in the vaudeville period or in the silent film period from the early, well, actually born in the late 1800s
Isn't that amazing? And when you look at some of the birth dates there, you know, late 1870s and 1880s, and, you know, that one in particular, there was a Jack Pajan, who was a bronco buster and a stunt rider, horseman, who ended up in the 1920s as an A-list movie star. You know, and Gilbert, you know, Pee Wee Holmes, who was a sidekick on many, many early films and worked alongside many, many, you know, talented, you know, notable names, including Tom Mix. And there were a family full of brothers, the Burns brothers, who were near complete mysteries, all three of them. So, yeah, there were so many different people that drifted, you know, from Montana. There was this pipeline that went from Montana to Hollywood. And I think the interesting thing, too, is that I tried to include other performing arts. Like, I didn't want to just, you know, relegate it to film. I mean, I included a lot of musicians, but there's also the entertainer that found fame and fortune as a choreographer, like Michael Smuin, who was the son of a Safeway butcher who one day decided that he wanted to dance, and he went on to this vibrant, dynamic career as a master of his craft. In fact, I found a letter in the Washington, D.C. archives from Nixon, you know, praising Michael Smuin for his sense of craft at a performance at the White House. So to me, I thought that was a little fun, maybe trying to add characters or, you know, maybe a dimension or two that might not always be associated with Montana. I mean, we do think of the Western, and the Western is paramount. Right.
Michael Smuin is very interesting because I worked at the Albert Hubert Theater as program director for years. And he would come bring this big modern dance company back to Montana every other year. And I never knew that connection, why he would want to be here.
Interesting.
And it was very, I wouldn't say it was inexpensive, but he obviously was doing it to come back to Montana. And it was fun reading in your book, wait a minute, that's the connection.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I've been putting up certain photos of different subjects and on Facebook and on the book's Facebook page. And I mentioned Smuin, and I posted a few photos of Smuin, and you're not the only one. In fact, you know, Ed Noonan, who's very well known in Helena for the arts, as a patron of the arts and a participant in the arts and a poet, he had sent me a message and said, I had no idea that that Michael had a connection to Montana. So,
well, if Ed Noonan didn't know about it, then I don't feel so bad.
Isn't that wild? But yeah, his parents, like I said, his dad, worked at Safeway. His parents were both active in community theater in Missoula. And it was interesting, his trajectory, because he tried boxing too. You know, he was on that path to take a different approach to life and maybe get into a sport, and decided he didn't like it. And right at around his early teens, he had, expressed his desire to dance. And he said, I guess apparently, as the story goes, he told his parents, he wasn't really comfortable wearing tights, but he's really interested in the movement and the elasticity of it, and just kind of the fluidity of dancing and movement.
Well, he was a wonderful dancer, mm-hmm. but he was an amazing choreographer. His shows were always so full of energy. Mm-hmm. He had both a sense of humor, and he knew how to put on a show. He loved the big musical numbers. Nice. So I wasn't surprised to find out that he had actually choreographed Anything Goes,
right.
which is amazing. And he won the Tony Award for that.
Correct. So. And I think one of the things that strikes me as important and is the fact that his parents encouraged him to do it. And I think that there could have been many points where they said, well, we're not taking you to the closest, organization that can help you do this. Mm-hmm. We're going to steer you in this direction. But you know what path they steered him on was the one that ultimately catalyzed all this greatness and catalyzed his greatness. They ended up taking him to Salt Lake City at the closest theater, our ballet troupe, apparently. And then it just, blossomed from there. Mm-hmm. But I think that's important. I think that's something to emphasize, where someone like and Michael Smuin, who didn't want to participate in sports and didn't want to be a Western actor, but right. he said, this is what feels good to me. This is what I want to do. And Bill Bowers is another example of that too, who's one of the
Bill Bowers is a dear friend of mine. I was so glad you included him.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm glad I included him too. I mean, he's one of the world's greatest living mimes, and he's from Lolo, and he grew up in a community that, where he felt very silent and very, very, repressed in many ways. And becoming a mime was just a natural extension of how he grew up. And I just think there's a value in hearing some of that, So I tried to include and incorporate, a couple of names and faces that you might not have, associate with mm-hmm. with our performing arts history.
Well, the early days, though, most of the people that made it to Hollywood were actual cowboys.
They were people
that knew how to ride rope. Uh-huh. And the golden age of Hollywood, there were a lot of Westerns. So who are some of those first famous cowboys that came out of Montana?
There's the earliest one, again, would be, a Pee Wee Holmes, and again, Jack Pajan, who came from Silverbow County.
He was Native American too, is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, you read and studied
I read
this.
The book.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, he was. Yeah, and it's interesting. You see some of that carrying on too, like with Chief Many Trees, who was another actor who was in a lot of movies in the 1920s, and the Western vein and the Western thread. I don't know if that really relented up until, maybe even the 90s, because if you look, there's, Walter Coy, who was a great character actor, who was from Great Falls. Most of those are Westerns. I mean, you look at the TV, his TV index and the encyclopedia of the films and television series he has been in. I mean, you look at, Burt Rumsey, who was the bartender on Gunsmoker, Ethan Laidlaw, who came out of Butte and was the stereotypical stout, bearded baddie and so mm-hmm. many different television shows. Those were all Westerns, yeah. So the Western part, yeah, Western lore is alive and well.
I thought it was very interesting that Chief Many Train lobbied to have real Native Americans play those parts, because I have seen many Westerns where there are Mexicans and Italians and white people with bad makeup on. And he was a very much of an activist to hire Native Americans.
Yeah, exactly. I know that's exactly, perfectly summarized and perfectly encapsulated is the fact that he must have had some clout because, there's old newspaper clippings with his name in there, and he's lobbying, for these parts, these quote unquote, ethnic roles to be played by the ethnic people, and it's really interesting as you point that out. Because if you look at Chief Manitou's roles, and it would just say, Iroquois or Iroquois chief, or and it would say Iroquois something else, and Chief Manitou's, had enough kind of muscle to appear in a way that he thought was authentic, and to encourage the film companies to hire actors who he felt, represented their culture and better than anyone else. So it's interesting, And that would have been, we're looking at almost 100 years ago that happened. So that is interesting, And you picked that up too.
Well, one of the other characters, obviously when you're looking at a book of Montana, you expect that there's going to be a lot of white people from small ranch towns. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, there were several Native Americans. And I think really the most surprising character who I knew a little bit about before was Taylor Gordon, who was an African-American from White Sulphur Springs. What a fascinating character. Tell us a little bit about Taylor Gordon.
Oh, man. Absolutely. It just brings a big smile to my face. I mean, I'm beaming when I hear that name. I think, it's so interesting that years ago I found there was an article in the Billings Gazette, maybe 1927, 1928, that referred to Taylor as, quote unquote, the Negro who put Montana on the map. And, barring, the verbiage, if they could have just said the entertainer that put Montana on the map, think about that. I mean, just think about how complimentary that is. I mean, just think about what Taylor had achieved and where he came from and his whole life. I mean, Taylor was, was the inspiration for so many different things. I mean, he was the inspiration for Ivan Dogg's story, which I mentioned in there. Mm-hmm. And he also wrote a book called Born to Be, an autobiography that was published in the late 1920s. That is just another beautiful piece of work. But here's a gentleman who grows up in White Sulphur Springs with the, and does everything in White Sulphur Springs, which at that time he refers to as like a cultured cow town. I guess there were a lot of grand pianos and a lot of the bars and a lot of the hotels. And he does everything that a kid can do. He hunts, he fishes, he's a pin setter too, and he has all these vivid, kind of interesting jobs. But he also has this phenomenal voice, and so he's friends with the Ringling family, and the Ringling family right next door in Ringling, Montana. Mm-hmm. And Taylor's hired as a porter. He's also hired as a chauffeur too, and he's worked.
So he got to travel. That was the interesting thing, that he actually was able to leave White Sulphur Springs and see the broader world.
He did, and he left with one of the Ringlings, and while he's on the train, working. He's singing as he works, and that voice is heard by someone else on the train who happens to be connected to the opera scene and running an opera house in Minnesota. And then Taylor goes on to become this vibrant, dynamic star and perform among kings and queens in Europe. And I just think there's something that's really powerful about it. I think here's a kid that, was working at a bowling alley, in White Sulphur Springs, setting pins, and then his voice took him all around the world, and eventually back to White Sulphur Springs too, because Taylor had some mental decline at one point where he was writing a lot, writing frequently, and he felt that John Steinbeck had stolen the Grapes of Wrath from him, and that something about that, pushed him into like a mental brink and the mental abyss. And fortunately, he had some family members who were still in White Sulphur Springs who brought him back. But in the, you know, toward the end of his life, he would have been in the gazebo. He would have been playing small town halls, and he would have been playing music, and he would have been with his sister who ran a cafe. And so this man who was a seminal kind of figure in this artistic, cultural epicenter of New York City came back to White Sulphur Springs.
Yeah. I knew a little bit about Taylor because I've been to White Sulphur Springs and a black man who puts White Sulphur Springs on the map. But here's a character I did not know about. I don't think many people know that one of the first famous female impersonators was from Butte, Montana. What a story that is. Can you tell us a little bit about Julian, and how do you pronounce the name?
Eltinge, yeah.
Julian Eltinge.
Well, I'm actually going to, I think two people might be able to summarize Julian Eltinge quite well. One of them was W.C. Fields, the comedian. So W.C. Fields once said that women went into ecstasy about him, men went into the smoking room. So that was about what Fields said. Yeah, Julian Eltinge, you know, was born in Massachusetts, but he ended up living in Butte, and that's where he was an usher at an opera house in Butte, and he always claimed that something about that experience galvanized great change in him, and he ended up taking, his birth name was Michael Dalton, but he took the name Julian Eltinge from a classmate, and he ran with it, and he went on to become America's first famous, you know, female impersonator.
And in regular theatrical productions. It wasn't like a drag show.
No. It wasn't a drag show. It wasn't anything.
They were full-length Broadway shows or Shakespeare.
Broadway
or
shows. Yep. They were movies. Yeah, they were. He was a star, and it's hard to underestimate his star power. There were several theaters named after him across the country. There's one in New York City, and there's one in the Dakotas of all places. And that kind of gives you an example of just how widespread, you know, his fame and popularity reached. Ruth Gordon is an actress, too, and I love this, so I'm going to just read you this paragraph. She said this in 1969, and when she was looking back on Julian's life, she said, Julian Eltinge, as virile as anybody virile, contributed to the gaiety of nations by playing fascinating widows more fascinatingly than if fascinating real widows played them. So she said that in the New York Times, and I always loved that. But yeah, he was performing in front of kings and in castles, and he always came back to Butte too, which is interesting. Like, he returned to do theater early 1900 or about late 19-teens. Mm-hmm. So he kept that, you know, he kept that connection with Butte for all these years, but.
So fascinating when you think about a black opera singer from White Sulphur Springs, a female impersonator from Butte, and how many of us knew that Hercules was from Montana, too?
That's true. He's another one, too. I always thought would be another dynamic biography or biography book. But Steve Reeves, was born in Glasgow and grew up in a small farming community outside of Glasgow. And apparently, like, his father had been killed in an accident, in a threshing accident. So his mother took Steve and his siblings and the Reeves family to Helena for a little while, and then they ended up in California. But yeah, Steve Reeves had an impeccable physique. I mean, he looks like Hercules, and he got into performing as a bodybuilder, and there were some big time film houses that saw him and said, okay, this guy has a look for Hercules, and he has a look for these gladiator roles. And Reeves was gladiatorial. You know, he was an action figure and an action hero, and he's the precursor to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. Before there was Arnold Schwarzenegger and Conan the Barbarian, there was Steve Reeves.
Brent, we're about out of time, but I really want to ask you about two of the actors that really were famous Hollywood stars, Gary Cooper and Myrna Loy.
Wow.
And I'm just wondering, what was it about those two that made them stars? Did they have something that from Montana or growing up in Montana that created a persona that made them the famous stars that they became?
I think they just had the benefit of wondrous genes. I mean, when you look at Gary Cooper, I mean, Gary Cooper set the mold. I mean, he defined Hollywood, you know, and the look of Hollywood for decades. And I think the one thing, not to deviate too far from the question, but about Cooper that's really interesting is that everyone was the next Gary Cooper. I mean, everybody and their cousin was the next Gary Cooper. And the next Gary Cooper, some of them were from Montana. One of them was a gentleman named Robert Bray, who was billed and as the next Gary Cooper. And then another one was Lane Chandler, who mm-hmm. spent some time in Helena, and who Gary and Lane were fishing guides in Yellowstone. And Lane Chandler followed Gary Cooper to Helena. And Lane Chandler got to Hollywood, and he was heralded and billed as the next Gary Cooper. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's really fun, too. That's where it gets even more fun, is that some of the next Gary Coopers also came from Montana as well. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Gary Cooper and Myrna Loy, it's really hard to understate their presence, you know, not only there, way out there, but also here. I mean, they've left an imprint and a legacy, and they've made such a great impact on our communities, even to this day. Where Gary Cooper, even though, you know, he spent some time in England, you know, he is associated with Helena, Montana, although he did spend some time also, you know, in Bozeman as well. But yeah, he's our product, and we're proud of him, and his name is, you know, synonymous maybe with a little bit part of our performing arts legacy. So.
And I'm so happy that the Myrna Loy Theater in Helena is named after Myrna Loy. And she really had a fairly close tie to Montana. And that's sort of a wonderful story, too.
She did, yeah. She did. And the Myrna Loy Center for the Performing Arts is just a fantastic place to be in, like, the widest sense of the word. And her family actually has a connection to the jail, as I know it. You know, one of her uncles was also a warden there, and he was so proud of it because it was built in such a stunning architectural sense.
Beautiful
and mode.
Building.
Correct. That he would have weddings there, and he would allow you know, folks from the community to come and visit and to see it, and he was quite proud of it. And it's a stunning building now, and I think it's a respectful and appropriate legacy for one of the all-time greats of film.
So the book is Montana Entertainers, Famous and Almost Forgotten. Ryan, thank you for being in the studio.
Thank you for having me. It's been too long, and I hope it isn't, I was going to say this long next time, but I hope I come around soon.
Keep writing.
Thank you.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.